This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
Why aren't people getting tattoos anymore? Because we're hearing from tattoo artists and they're saying it is bad at the moment, really bad. They're having to find second jobs, close their shops. So is it all financial? Is it all the cost of living? Or is there a bit more at play here? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're going to dive into this tattoo downturn.
Tattooing's kind of on its ass in Australia. This has definitely sort of been a prolonged, gnarly, quiet period that's lasted well over a year.
Yeah, I want to hear from you as well if you're big into tats, if you've got them yourself, if you've struggled to maybe find a good tattoo artist recently because favourite places closed. 0439757555. Also going to be bringing you some disturbing allegations against an Australia in Syria. We've got this special investigation an ABC reporter has been part of. First, though...
You're listening to Hack.
A major outage is impacting Telstra users right across Australia.
On Triple J.
Not being able to call, message, trains down, potential impacts to 000 calls... Were you one of the thousands of people affected by that Telstra outage this morning? Because there was a huge network issue and it ended up impacting mobile phone and data connection, payments. In some cities, it brought public transport to a standstill. I really want to know how this impacted you. Like, if you got up in the morning and thought, what is going on here? I can't get on with my day as normal. What happened? 0439757555. Evelyn Manfield's been looking into it.
It was just SOS mode. Couldn't make any calls, couldn't access any internet.
Yeah, I couldn't get my texts. I couldn't play my music.
It was a bad day for Telstra customers hit by a massive outage at 4:30 this morning. Here's the Prime Minister.
This is deeply concerning and it's very disruptive to people's lives.
And Communications Minister Annika Wells.
There is a reason that telcos are the least trusted industry in Australia. It's days like today. It is on all telcos to improve their systems.
Not being able to use Google Maps was a mess around.
I couldn't even make a phone call this morning. It was really frustrating.
Phones were down, payments couldn't process. The WA Police told people to check in with vulnerable family members in case they couldn't reach 000, and trains were even brought to a halt across regional Victoria and New South Wales.
Obviously not ideal, but we've heading out to Ballarat this morning, so got to find a new way of getting out there.
I woke up at 5:30 to go to the work, and now I'm going back home.
Other mobile providers like Boost, Aldi and Belong that operate on Telstra's network were also reporting outages, though not all customers were impacted. This morning, Telstra was assuring users they were on it and were advising people to try again if they were having connectivity problems. By about 10 o'clock, the telco said it had restored a lot of services. Here's the Chief Financial Officer, Michael Ackland.
We believe that just under 90% of calls and data services at this point are now working.
The government says there's no evidence it was caused by anything malicious. So how did this happen? Well, as of this morning, Telstra said...
We don't yet know the root cause.
What they do know is that it caused some nodes to malfunction. To get technical, the nodes help to synchronise time across the network. And Telstra says when they're not working as they should, it can lead to other problems. But what caused that malfunction is still TBC. But the PM has noted...
None of it is, of course, acceptable because it's disruptive.
As for calls to 000, Telstra says they were not impacted in the same way, but there were some disruptions. When 000 calls fail, Telstra says it does welfare checks, and as of 10:30 this morning, it had about 36 across the country it was doing. Here's Annika Wells again explaining how that works.
Telstra tries to call these numbers. If they're unable to get onto them, they pass those along to the territory and state emergency providers. I would imagine there will be people that will have needed further support from emergency providers. Off the top of my head, I think he named one.
But the government says the backup system of calls diverting to other networks did work. Now, Telstra asked customers not to call 000 to check if it was working, but Shadow Communications Minister Sarah Henderson did anyway.
I actually tested it myself.
Telling Sky News,
Telstra is making very clear, please do not test 000. I had a couple of failed calls this morning because obviously I needed to know if 000 was working.
A decision Emergency Management Minister Christy McBain scolded.
The last thing we need is anyone making test calls to 000. We teach our kids not to prank call 000, and I think it is absolutely outrageous that the Shadow Communications Minister has been making test calls.
If this is all sounding a bit familiar, it's because Australia has faced several outages in recent years. Telecommunications expert at RMIT University, Associate Professor Mark Gregory, says it's not good enough.
The problem is that no one's learning any lessons. The number of outages in Australia is unbelievable. It's unacceptable in the modern era.
One of those outages was in September last year, and it meant hundreds of people couldn't reach 000, and it's been linked to the deaths of two people.
This, in its nature, is a very different kind of outage. What happened in September was a 000 outage where nobody knew 000 was offline.
The government has previously raised penalties for telcos, made them report real-time outages to the Communications Authority, and legislated a 000 custodian, which oversees the system.
We know that customers across the whole community rely on our connectivity, and this network challenge has caused many issues and it's been a big disruption to many people's days, and we apologise for that.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Evelyn Manfield reporting there, and I should say Telstra's said in a press conference this afternoon that they are confident they have detected a software defect and that they're also advising customers to be extra vigilant about calls from people who are claiming to be Telstra, because there are fraudsters who are trying to take advantage at the moment. We're getting a lot of messages from you telling us what the outage meant for you. Someone saying, I was using my GPS and listening to a podcast, but I couldn't text my client to let him know I was there because I had no internet connection. I was really confused. Someone else saying, I work with at-risk vulnerable youth, so not having access to call or text anybody could have led to significant incidents. Absolutely ridiculous. We also heard from listener Kaylee. This is what Kaylee's experience was.
I'm from Sydney, and this morning I got stuck on an e-bike while commuting to work because of the outage. I tried like again and again and again, but just had no service. And then I was like, oh my God, I'm literally about to be locked to this thing all day.
Okay, so some experiences more intense than others, but you know, Kaylee, stuck on the bike, that can be really tricky as well. Look, I do want to hear from you. Message in 0439757555. I want to get into a bit of an explanation into what happened here. And with us now is Associate Professor Paul Gardner-Stephen from Flinders University. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Hey, my pleasure.
What happened here? Because there was a lot of chaos.
There is a lot of chaos. And I think it's really interesting that the 000 piece, as hard as it is actually kind of the tip of the iceberg. What seems to have happened, and we don't need to have full information, is that the network time protocol systems in Telstra were malfunctioning in some way. And so timing was not being consistent between different things. And it turns out that's actually really, really important for all sorts of things that have been built in the modern world, that when you do a web browser connection with HTTPS, the S for secure, expects there to be tight timing synchronization between your computer and the server so that it can make sure there's various naughty things that aren't happening. And it turns out this dependency clearly is baked into e-bike systems now as well, regional train systems and traffic control systems here in Adelaide, and FPOS systems. And so it's really exposed the vulnerability of Australia in having all of these systems that are so tightly dependent on this system. And in most of the cases, there hasn't been a graceful fallback. The one, good news story out of that actually was the Adelaide traffic light system, which reverted back to, the old style of just, guess how long each, sequence needs to be instead of having it all, computer optimized. So it degraded gracefully, which is great. But a train system shutting down, that's not graceful degradation. And that's a sign of the kind of risks that we're facing. Whether it is an innocent event or whether, a hostile actor, is trying to upset our way of life.
Yeah, it's a really kind of concerning reminder of how interconnected everything is. And I mean, there was some information out there early on, misinformation, people saying this is an attack by a foreign power and it's a hack and that's what's caused all of it. How possible is that? Like, could that happen one day?
Yes, is the very short, unadorned answer. And that's what's got me kind of quite worked up about the whole situation, is that it's really brought home to us, here is a system which is so fragile, because in fact, if Telstra says the time is, you know, is 8 o'clock and GPS says it's 9 o'clock, or, you know, something else says it's 10 o'clock, yes, you don't have to deny any one of them. You just have to kind of mess with one of them enough that the consensus fails. And then all of these kind of cascade events happen there. So I think as a nation, we really need to have a look, and as all Western nations, in fact, at this vulnerability and go, well, this wouldn't be that hard to interfere with. I mean, Russia and China are both quite well known to operate GPS spoofing, not just denial. They can kind of, you know, make up information and both look like they're in the middle of land, or, you know, on top of Mount Everest, or all sorts of things. And if they started doing that with the timing, it's very clear that that can cause, you know, society to grind, you know, to a halt or fall to its knees. And we must, as a nation, you know, bake in graceful degradation into these systems so that, you know, that doesn't happen. You know,
yeah.
Trains can be controlled by people waving red and green flags. It just surprises me that they didn't have a fallback solution to allow safe operation of some capacity on that rail network, you know, in the absence of, you know, computer connectivity.
It is really interesting, and people were a bit stunned, I think, and they have been a few different times over history where we've had these outages and things have gone down and it feels like there's not the fail-safe systems in place. We're hearing from people on the text line now, someone's saying my uni shut down all lifts for the day because the emergency call buttons wouldn't work with the outage. Some people had accessibility issues. Another person, Sienna, saying I had personally loved this outage because I finally got some peace and quiet. All right, Sienna, you're one of the few who was just cheering about the outage. Yeah. Nikita saying I'm still experiencing some issues. And another person saying patients at our clinic could not reach us to let us know if they were running late or unable to attend their appointments. We also had new patients who could not navigate to our clinic, and they were really stressed about that. You can imagine there was a lot of stress this morning. I'm speaking with Dr. Paul Gardner-Stephen from Flinders University. We're talking about this Telstra outage, what was behind it, what we can kind of do to avoid it, and what we need to be considering going forward. Paul, I mean, especially regional communities are often impacted hard by these kinds of outages because often they only have one operator, which services a large, large area. Do you think we really need to focus on regional Australia and the way it is connected?
Yeah, look, I mean, regional Australia has always been challenging to, you know, to get the infrastructure there. We've lived in the middle of the outback in Arkaroola ourselves, and so we know it firsthand. And having multiple phone networks provide coverage all through that vast area is economically very difficult. But Starlink actually now provides a good kind of, you know, second fiddle to that. And I think, you know, making good use of the satellite to complement, you know, the ground networks is a good thing. Looping back around to the 000 problem, you know, again, we've spoken now about, you know, a number of these events that have happened. It really feels to me like the complexity of 000 in the 4G and 5G mobile networks is way higher than it should be for resilience and for this graceful degradation, that maybe actually the time has come for the federal government to think about mandating having a 2G 000 service only, that is everywhere, and whether the government runs it themselves or whether the telcos still operate the very low cost tower infrastructure compared to the 3G, 4G, 5G stuff that they're running, because, you know, it's like those old Nokia phones, right? You know, you throw them at a battleship and the battleship sinks. the 2G 000 service is, unless you overload it with too many calls, it's effectively impossible to sync.
That's interesting. And so, yeah. And something that, you know, I'm sure people would be hearing now and thinking, okay, that does sound like a smart solution. Maybe. Look, thank you very much for coming on and having a chat with us about what we have seen today and what we might be able to expect in the future. Associate Professor Paul Gardner-Stephen from Flinders Uni. Really appreciate your time. and some messages coming through, someone saying nothing's ever going to work 100% of the time. People should have their own fail-safe organised for when network outages happen. Okay, yeah, that's a big kind of a big thing to put on people, I guess. Someone else saying, I downgraded to a dumb phone yesterday and thought it was just me. I enjoyed a morning without distractions. It was bliss. Here's what Andy had to say.
I'm Andy, a community physio based in southeast Queensland. I service regional and rural clients. The outage has really affected my ability to be able to complete my notes, and also it's created a barrier for the healthcare industry devices to keep these records that are extremely important.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Someone else on the text line is saying, we've built our society to rely on technology, but technology does fail. It's going to happen. Bring back analog life. All right, we're going to move on.
Hack.
The last of the known Australian women linked to the Islamic State group is expected to return home amid allegations she kept a slave.
On Triple J.
Yeah, look, there are some really disturbing allegations in this story. It's an ABC investigation into the last known ISIS-linked Australian woman still in Syria. Now, her name is Hodan Abbey. She's from Sydney and she will return home to Australia after travelling to Syria in 2014. This woman, Hodan Abbey, is facing allegations from a Yazidi woman who says she was beaten and raped while enslaved in the Australian woman's home in Syria a decade ago. Let's find out a bit more about this with ABC senior reporter Stephanie March, who's been leading this investigation. Steph, thank you so much for joining us. I mean, as I say, very disturbing allegations. Can you tell us more about who this Yazidi woman is you've spoken to and what she's told you?
Yeah, sure. So I've spoken to a Yazidi victim who we'll call Sarah to protect her identity and a witness who we'll call Layla. And both of them have told me that in Raqqa in Syria in 2016, Sarah was held in the home of a foreign ISIS fighter who she knew as Abu Osama and his wife who she knew as Osama. Now, Osama, we believe, is believed to be Hodan Abbey. And what the victim told me and the witness corroborated that when she was in this home, Abu Osama raped her repeatedly. She claims that once his wife found out that she was being raped, she was taken to a neighbour's house and he would rape her in secret there. She alleges that Osama, the foreign fighter's wife, that she would beat her, that she was clearly very upset that she was being raped by her husband, that at one point she locked her in the bathroom for several days. Now, these Yazidi women, Sarah and Layla, the witness who I've spoken to, they didn't know Osama's real name at the time, but she is believed to be this Australian girl who left Western Sydney, Hodan Abbey. So the identification is not definitive, but we've spoken to a former UN human rights specialist who has spent years working on and investigating ISIS cases. And he says, based off statements from multiple Yazidi survivors, he believes that the woman in question is Hodan Abbey. And we've also in our investigation confirmed with a terrorism expert here in Australia that while Hodan Abbey was living in the ISIS caliphate, she did go by the name Osama. And another piece of evidence that aligns is we know that Hodan Abbey now has a 9-year-old daughter who was born in about mid-2016. And that's about the same time that Sarah claims she was being held in the Osama house. And she recalls Osama being pregnant and giving birth to a daughter at that time.
Do we know much about Hodan Abbey's time in Syria, Steph?
Not at the moment. It's very limited, especially compared to some of the other women who've been held in those Kurdish detention camps who have chosen to speak out over the years to various media outlets as they've tried to make their way back to Australia. Very little is known about Hodan Abbey. There's no photograph of her in the public domain of her time in Syria or even before she left. She left her Western Sydney home in 2014 when she was just 18 years old with a friend of hers, Hafsa Muhammad, and they ended up in Syria. Now, there were reports at the time that Hafsa Muhammad had been posting online that she wanted to marry a jihadi fighter and die alongside him as a martyr. And as the years have gone on, it doesn't seem like Hodan Abbey has spoken directly to any media outlets, but there have been reports that she's claimed that she was tricked and trafficked into Syria and that she wants to come home to get treatment for her sick daughter, who she says was injured with shrapnel when she was quite young and has some very severe injuries that she's been unable to get treatment for in Syria.
Have you managed to speak to Hodan Abbey at all or anyone who's representing her?
No, so we haven't been able to talk to Hodan Abbey. She's somewhere in Syria. There's mixed reports whether she's being held in Idlib in the north, which is sort of a government stronghold, or whether she's being held somewhere in Damascus. The Syrian government have said they've got a media blackout on her. They're not giving anyone, any media, any information about her whereabouts or what's happening with her. She has been issued what's called a return permit to come home. So earlier this year, the Home Affairs Minister put a temporary exclusion order on her, which is something that prevents someone who's deemed a terrorism or security threat from coming back to Australia. Now, she can then apply for a return permit, which has to be issued, but she's been slapped with a number of conditions, like she's not allowed to have a phone, she's not allowed to use the internet, she has to tell authorities where she's living, etc. So she could come home any day. We've tried talking to her lawyers and her family. The family have not responded, neither have the lawyers, to these specific allegations. But one lawyer who did help Ms. Abbey and some of those other ISIS-linked Australians get their passports earlier in the year has described her case as being sad, complex and misunderstood. But again, at this time, no one's spoken directly about these allegations.
What about authorities here? Because if this is the same person, could Hodan Abbey be facing charges here in Australia? And do we not know when she could arrive back in this country?
She could technically come back any day, is our understanding. We've spoken to international law experts who say that, yes, she could very well be charged with potentially a variety of offences if the Australian Federal Police believe they have evidence to back up these claims or other claims that they may know about. Obviously, some of the women who've come back from Syria have been charged, two women in Melbourne with slavery-related offences last month. Other women have been charged with entering designated terrorist areas. So it's a possibility. We've asked the Australian Federal Police whether they're aware of these allegations and if they do have any plans to charge Hodan Abbey, and they've just said no comment.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with ABC reporter Stephanie March about her investigation into the last known ISIS-linked Australian woman who is still in Syria and some disturbing allegations from a Yazidi woman who claims she was abused while enslaved by an Australian. Steph, I mean, you've been following the plight of Yazidi people for more than a decade now. What has that been like?
Yeah, I've been to northern Iraq, which is the homeland of the Yazidis, where they were, just to remind people, because it is a long time ago, yeah. It's more than 10 years ago now. It was in August 2014 when ISIS was taking control of territory across Syria and Iraq, and ISIS fighters essentially overran these villages, home to this Yazidi minority group. And at one point they pushed thousands of these Yazidis up this mountain, Mount Sinjar. Some of them died from dehydration and starvation while they were stuck there before international forces could rescue them. And in that process, thousands of men were killed, thousands of women and children were enslaved. And we're still seeing the effects of that today. So I did a story in 2023 in northern Iraq about the legacy of ISIS on the Yazidi community. And at that time, there were still people who were enslaved by ISIS members in other countries, in Turkey, in parts of Syria and parts of Iraq. When we were there, we actually met up with a woman who had just been freed after 10 years in captivity, and her husband had waited for her. He refused to apply for refugee status in other countries, and he waited for her. And when we met them, they just reunited, and we were there at their wedding. They were renewing their vows. It was remarkable. So, and there's still people in the Yazidi community who are searching for their loved ones, who have no idea where they are, whether they're dead, they're alive, whether they're in these camps hiding, because that's another complicated factor. Some of these Yazidi women had children to their ISIS captors. They don't want to have to give those children up because their communities don't accept them. So some of them have been hiding in these ISIS camps, not wanting to give up their children. So it's a really complicated story that, and we covered a lot of that in 2023. And it's a story that goes on for the Yazidi community. You know, their fight to get justice in countries across the world, because there was foreign fighters from all over the world that travelled to the self-declared ISIS caliphate. It continues. And as we've seen in Australia, it's, you know, probably going to continue for some time.
Yeah, a lot of thoughts on this one. And can also read the latest on this story on ABC News Online. But for now, ABC reporter Stephanie March, really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Steph.
Hack. It feels like that just years ago, tattoos were literally everywhere. But lately, something has changed.
On Triple J.
Yeah, shops are closing. Artists who've been working in this industry for decades are packing up, getting other jobs. What is happening with the tattoo industry here in Australia? Maybe you have some intel because you love tats. You've been getting them for ages. Have you noticed a decline? Maybe your favourite shop has closed down. 0439 757 555. We're already hearing from a lot of people on the text line. Someone's saying, I'd love to get more tats, but the cost of living is so high, I've got nothing for savings, let alone art. It's something that Shannon Schubert has been looking into.
Easy, hey.
TJ Day is a tattoo artist at Heart and Soul in Melbourne CBD. On the day I visited, she had no appointments booked, but two people walked in and got a small tattoo.
So maybe you could look at some clouds you like.
Business has definitely changed the past 12 months. Yeah, it's gotten a lot quieter than it used to be.
Five tattooists work out of the studio, but today she's the only one working.
The bookings are a little bit more spaced out. People getting large work, they want to space out their appointments maybe, just watching the budget a bit.
Tattooing's kind of on its ass in Australia.
Michael Forrest has been a tattoo artist in Melbourne for 12 years. He says business is the quietest it's been since he started.
Sometimes you have sort of like seasonal quiet periods, but this has definitely sort of been a prolonged, gnarly quiet period that's lasted well over a year.
He says it's so quiet that some artists are picking up second jobs to pay the bills.
They might be getting a second job driving Ubers or, you know, working in bars. Some people doing OnlyFans content.
But others are leaving the industry altogether.
Some weeks I'd be super busy, then other weeks I'd have maybe one or two clients.
Georgia Fogarty left her job as a full-time tattooist a year ago for a stable full-time job at a health insurance company.
Half just because I wanted a bit of a change of scenery, but the other half was just because of the instability of the tattoo industry right now.
She started just after COVID and did it full-time for 3 years.
I'd say like at my busiest, maybe 2 years ago, I was out 2-3 months in advance with about 4 or 5 clients every single day, but now it's just completely changed.
Michael says it's been sad to hear two businesses in Melbourne that have been around for more than 30 years are now closing their doors.
Shops can't stay open if people aren't getting tattooed, and we're seeing like a lot of shops over the last couple of years just closing, just dropping like flies.
According to the latest data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, more than 370,000 businesses stopped operating in 2024 to 25. That's an exit rate of almost 14%. And while more businesses have opened than closed over the last 4 years, the number closing has been slowly increasing over time. So why is it so quiet? Well, the people I spoke to said one of the biggest factors is the rising cost of living, meaning people are spending less on things that aren't essential.
Well, I wonder if it will become this thing where you're sort of a hobbyist and have to supplement your income in other ways.
Michael thinks another reason for the slump is an oversaturation of tattooists, with a lot starting out after COVID.
More tattooers now than there ever has been, but you also have cost of living crisis that's affecting everyone.
Another factor is expensive insurance and the challenges of running a small business. Here's Georgia again.
There's a lot of other responsibilities that come with that, like tax and super and managing your own books. And for me, I found it was a really 24-hour a day kind of job, responding to clients after hours, doing stencils every night.
You could have a seat and have a little look, but yeah, I've got time, I can do it today.
Yeah.
Despite the challenges, TJ loves tattooing.
Tattooing's definitely changed a lot. It's a lot to get into tattooing, and you really have to love it.
Hack on Triple J.
Shannon Schubert reporting there. We're hearing from so many of you on the text line now. Calvin from Melbourne saying it all goes back to rental prices. Small businesses getting smothered as per usual. Adam in Marrickville in Sydney, cost of everything has gone up. Wages have not. I simply can't afford to add to my collection of tats right now, especially because a lot of people charge hundreds of dollars per hour. I've actually got Brett on the line with us now. Brett is a tattoo artist in Sydney. Brett, have you kind of seen this in your experience, that people aren't getting tats as much as they used to?
Oh, definitely, yeah. There's been a slowing down of tattooing. Probably just after post-COVID, there was a bit of a boom, and then that slowly dropped off as things got back to usual.
And it's been hard to probably stay afloat for a lot of these tattoo artists, Brett.
I guess what it is, yeah. I mean, like, at the end of the day, you know, it's the old adage of, like, the strong will survive, you know, and plenty of people will stop. Like, there's been a lot of people who got into it during or just after COVID,
yeah,
who announced their retirement, you know, oh, I've tattooed for 3 years and I think it's time for me to exit. And it's like, okay, goodbye.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Brett. Look, thank you so much for having a chat with us. And yeah, we're hearing a lot of stories from people who wish they could get tattoos, but really they're just... can't afford it. Like, they just can't, you know, waste their savings if they've managed to get any savings. But it doesn't mean they don't want them. Well, that is all we've got time for on Hack for now.